All right, I have started the recorder, and we are at NTI Galatians chapter 4, which in the Kindle is on page 330. Anybody have a page number for the paperback? Is it the same?
It's the same.
330. Okay, so here we go. NTI Galatians chapter 4. The message that you hear from my lips is a consistent message. It is the message of love and freedom. You can misunderstand my message when you listen through the ears of judgment. You can take my message of freedom and make of it a slave. In this way, my message is lost to you. I ask you to lay down your judgment and listen to me with clarity. Lay aside your own wishes that you may know what it is that I say. So here we're literally being asked to let go of judging what is about to be said. So, whether it's me or whether it's you or all of us, definitely the scribe was probably going to judge this and have trouble writing it. I think I told you guys I was having a lot of trouble writing Galatians, because it was coming from the voice of Jesus, and that just messed me up big time for some reason. But you guys can let me know as we read this, see if what was about to be taught is something that you find yourself tempted to judge. Notice if you're having some kind of resistance to what's being taught, because we're kind of being asked in advance to lay our judgment aside, which says that maybe there's something here that we aren't going to be so open to accepting. So let's find out. The world is something you look upon and believe is real. When you make this mistake, you pay homage to a false god. Your false god takes many forms, but always its purpose is the same. It is the purpose you have given it. The purpose of the world, as it is seen and believed, is to tell you that you are separate. When you believe the world, this is the message you receive. So that's pretty simple. And I think that, if we all look at it for even a second, we realize it's true. If I'm not focused spiritually in some way, focused on being from the heart or something, if I just totally forget and I'm just believing the world, just sitting here having a conversation with you guys, if I'm not focused spiritually, then there's a me and a Susie and a me and a Dave. And, it can be a completely benign situation, and yet it teaches me that I'm separate, right? So this is saying that the world is like a false god, so we worship it. You worship a false god, but what we get from our false god is the belief that we're separate. That's the benefit that we get from our worship. Sentence 7. Do not judge yourself for believing the world. When you judge yourself, you agree you are separate. For in order to be judged, you must be separate from something that you can be judged against. My purpose for this discussion is not to judge you or to tempt you to judge yourself, but to help you to see what you do with the power of your mind. Now, something that's coming soon, in fact, I think it might even be the next book, is Ephesians. And what Ephesians and NTI teaches us is how even the message of separation is one. It teaches us, for example, that if we want to believe that we are separate, if that's what we want, then everything in the world shows up for us to convince us that that is true. A salesperson at Walmart that's rubbing us the wrong way. In that moment, we're convinced we're separate. There's a him and there's a me, and I don't like this, right? And it's saying that everything is showing up to teach us that we're separate because we want to believe we're separate. However, that's oneness giving what we want. This sentence is not in NTI, the one I'm about to quote, but it's a sentence that came through me, which many people who know it quote. It's the love is sentence. Love is giving to Spirit, through Spirit, that which Spirit wants. The interesting thing about that particular sentence is it doesn't say love is giving to your brother, you know, from another, right? It's all talking about one thing. Love is giving through Spirit, to Spirit, that which Spirit wants. The only thing that's happening there is Spirit, right? But also, what this means is that even, you know, what we would perceive the evilest or the meanest or the rudest acts are actually love. Because if I still want to, you guys are flirting?
I noticed too, but I'll let it go.
Sending messages across the room to each other. If you still have in yourself this desire to believe that you're separate, which is really just this desire to believe that I'm me, right? I'm this person, I'm me, right? If you have that, then what happens is everything in the universe provides you the opportunity to believe that because you want to, which means it's love. It's giving you what you ask for. So it may appear as attack, you know, somebody cussing me out, you know, because I cut them off in traffic. But it's love because I still have this desire to believe that I'm separate. And here's a great opportunity. I got some guy cussing me out on the road, you know. It's a great opportunity to believe that I'm separate. So we're going to get into that next. That's NTI Ephesians. But what this is telling us as we're starting to get into this is it's saying basically as you start to realize this, as you start to realize, for example, that the appearance of attack is there, because you want to believe you're separate, don't judge yourself for that. Because that's a mistake that a lot of people make. When a lot of people begin to realize that what we call the bad things in the world, you know, disease, starvation, war, is all there or appears there because I wanted to believe I'm a separate me, then what a lot of people do is they judge themselves for that. They think, oh, what a horrible, you know, being I am to have created all of this, right? And what this is saying is don't judge yourself. This isn't why you're being taught this. And in fact, this is the very beginning of several books in NTI that actually become much more advanced than what we've been studying so far. It's almost like once you start Galatians is almost like a bridge from what I would call beginning and intermediate NTI to advanced NTI. And so we're fixing to cross over this bridge into advanced NTI. But what it really wants to help us see is it wants to help us see how we ask for the experience of separation. Because until we see how we ask for the experience of separation, we continue asking without even noticing. And therefore we keep having without even noticing. So it wants to enlighten us to our habits, but it doesn't want us to judge ourselves for our habits, right? And so, again, Jesus is saying, do not judge yourself for this.
And every opportunity, every invitation to see yourself as separate is also an opportunity to see the opposite.
Yes. Absolutely. That's, yes. Yeah, I'm going to repeat that just in case it wasn't heard. Tom said every opportunity to see yourself as separate is also an invitation to the opposite, which means not to see that. And in fact, I'll just tell a real quick story, which is how I learned that. In fact, this is where the love is sentence came from. There was something going on in the course community once where it appeared that two course teachers were attacking each other. And pretty much everybody was aware of this story at the time. It was in the, you know, in the course media. You know, it was out in front of everybody's face. And so it appeared that these two teachers were attacking each other. And in fact, then everybody was talking about it. It was a topic of conversation in posts. And you would keep seeing people type things like, well, you know, so-and-so attacked so-and-so. And the other person saying, no, so-and-so attacked so-and-so. And I kept seeing this word attack. And every time I would read this word attack, I would hear like this little no. And I felt intuitively that the no was trying to tell me there was no attack there. Even though it looked incredibly obvious that there was, right, to my mind and everybody else's mind. But finally, after a few days of this no, 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 I decided to ask, and this is when I used to scribe, I decided to ask, is attack possible? Because it seemed like this no was trying to tell me it wasn't. And that's when this message came. explaining to me that everything is love. Love is giving through Spirit to Spirit that which Spirit requests. So even this appearance of attack that we see going on here is love. And everyone who's seeing attack or feeling attacked really still just wants the belief in separation. And this whole story is proving it for them. So they're getting it, and it's love. And so I get this message, and I have the opportunity to teach this message on Pow Talk. And then, Dove, for some reason that day, called me up and said, "Hey, Regina, I'm going to replay your teaching. Why don't you come listen to it?" He'd never did that before. So I went and listened to it, and I heard this my teaching on this message. So I got to review this message a few times right after it came. And then what happened is one of the two teachers involved in the apparent attack saw my message because I had posted it, and he felt attacked by my message. Okay? So he wrote an email to the moderators of his Yahoo discussion group telling them not to allow me to ever post on the group again. And I don't remember everything he said, but I remember he said that, you know, the only reason I was posting is because I was a wannabe, you know, wannabe teacher. And at first, when I got this email from, and he CC'd me on it, so I knew about it. So at first, when I got this email from him, at first, I felt attacked, you know? But then, the next second, what happened was everything I had learned in this message that morning came flooding back. And what I saw was, he was offering me the opportunity to let go of believing an attack now. And if he hadn't offered me an apparent attack, I couldn't turn it down. But I saw that it was coming to me as a gift of love to say, do you still want to play this game, or are you done with it? I mean, this wasn't an intellectual thing. I mean, it sounds intellectual, but I felt it in my heart. It's like in one instant, because, you know, I knew what this guy looked like, so in one instant, when I first opened the email, I saw his face all scratched up and all scrunched up and angry in my mind's eye. But then when it changed in the next instant to where I saw it was happening, he was standing tall in a tuxedo with a silver tray, like he was offering me an opportunity on that silver tray. And I suddenly became very, very happy. And I chose in that instant to accept that there was no such thing as attack. And I have never actually believed an attack since. You know, it's just not how I see. I can still use that language. It's kind of funny. Like I can say, oh yeah, well so-and-so, you know, he's getting a little attacking there. But there's a difference between using words and actually believing something. I don't know how to say that. And I have never believed an attack since. I can see when people are believing ego and they're getting kind of attacking, but that's different than believing so-and-so is actually attacking someone. What I really see is just people believing their own thoughts and expressing them. And sometimes those thoughts are angry-type thoughts, right? But I don't actually believe anybody can be attacked. I now know that you can only feel attacked if you want to. And it doesn't matter what somebody says to you. No one can actually attack you. Right? You can only feel attacked if you want to. So I told that story because of what Tom said. That, you know, not only are they offering you the opportunity to believe that you're separate, but if you're ready for it, they're offering you the opportunity not to do the exact same action. Right?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, so starting with sentence 11. I said that the world is a false god. Every part of it is an idol. Each idol represents the God, so that even the false message of separateness is one. So just to use an example, before we started the recording, one of our friends here in the room was talking about how sometimes he gets upset at these reality shows because they appear so stupid, and how could people really be interested in these shows? Well, what this is saying is that all of these reality shows, all of everything that we experience in this world is an idol serving the God, and the God is the world, which is our outward picture of our desire to believe that we're separate. So everything is an idol. Another example of an idol are bright colored sneakers. This week I went shopping because I need some new sneakers. Have you shopped for sneakers lately?
No, but I saw your post on Facebook.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I mean, I went to store after store after store, and I could not envision myself wearing any of those sneakers. They're so bright. It's the thing. And I realize I will have to because I need sneakers, and I will adjust. But, you know, even the sense of, you know, bright colored sneakers can make you feel separate. Like, I can't wear those. That's not who I am, you know. You know, so everything in the world, if we're still wanting the belief in separation, everything in the world is an idol to help us do that, to help us do what we want to do, believe that I'm a separate person. I'm a person who cannot wear bright sneakers. Now, of course, after Christmas, I'm sure you'll see me sitting here with my new bright sneakers. So I'm going to ask for some. I just don't know which ones yet. But you know, it'll be fun to see which ones I end up with. Okay, so sentence 14. Let's take a moment to look at a few of the idols that teach the message of their God. Let's look at the way this message is sent, received, and learned. The world contains different people with different personalities and different points of view. Sometimes commonalities between people are strong, but always there are differences to keep them apart. So, again, we have, you know, some of the popular groups, you know, that traditionally don't love each other in our world, or at least in the last 100 years. Some of them are coming a little closer now, but, you know, we have the Arabs and the Jews, you know, historically, but this one is beginning to change. We've had the blacks and the whites in America and South Africa. You know, what are some other typical groups that don't like each other? Those are the two really popular ones. The what?
Yankee fans and Mets fans.
Yankee fans and... I thought it was Yankee fans and Boston fans. Oh. Or Yankee fans and Mets fans. Yeah, so we have these traditional groups of people who don't like each other in our story of the world. And then, but you, then if you get within those groups of people where they're supposed to be, you know, they're the birds of a feather who are supposed to flock together, right? So you get, you know, all the Jewish people together, you know, they're going to have conflicts too.
Yeah.
Get all the black people together, they're going to have conflicts. Get all the Yankee fans together, they're going to have conflicts. So, you know, there's this sense that these are my people, these people who study NTI, these are my people. But if we all started living together in a house 24 hours a day, pretty soon we'd probably be like, well, yeah, but she's not, you know, because, you know. So, you know, we have this sense of commonality with somebody and this sense of not common with somebody else as a group. But even that's an illusion, because if you get within our group of common people, we're still going to find conflicts. So the world gives us this sense of commonality because our natural spirit needs that. We, you know, we would never accept the world as a false god if we never felt one with something, right? We would reject it entirely. It would be too much for us. We have to feel one with, right? So we have this illusory of one with the Yankee fans when the game's happening, you know, or you know, one with the Jews when we're in conflict with the Arabs right now. You know, I'm on the Jewish side if I'm a Jew. So we have this feeling of oneness, but it's an illusory feeling of oneness, because if you really look closely, even within my common group, I'm going to find separation.
Sounds a lot like the special relationship from the Course.
The special relationship from the Course. Yes, you're right. It does sound like the person I'm in love with, or my child, that's somebody I'm one with, and yet there's hate and conflict there as well. But you can see how it's kind of a crafty God, because it gives us that illusion of oneness. And we have to have that. If we don't have at least that, we would never believe the world. We wouldn't give it a chance, right? Okay, so starting with sentence 20. The world offers experiences that you may learn from, adapt to, and enjoy. Masses of people may share the same experiences and join through them. But always there are others with different experiences with whom you cannot seem to join. So this is the... Oh, I skipped a paragraph. We'll go back to 18. I skipped it. But this is the same type of thing. You know, we may really enjoy hiking. You know, we love hiking. And when we're out hiking, we feel one with the people we're hiking with. And we feel, you know, one with nature. And, you know, this experience is wonderful. We may enjoy bird watching. You know, when we're out there watching the birds, you know, everything's wonderful. The world gives us these experiences of happiness. You know, because our natural spirit has to have happiness. We wouldn't accept a world where there was no happiness in it. Even if our happiness only comes when we're eating chocolate cake, we got to have that chocolate cake. We would never accept a world with zero happiness. But at the same time, the world continues to present conflict. You know, if we love hiking and hiking is our thing, at some point we're going to run into somebody who every time we start talking about hiking, they start talking about the negative aspects of hiking, the bears, the mosquitoes, you know, and pretty soon they're getting on our nerves because they're bashing up our favorite activity,
lost.
You know. What, getting lost?
Lost, frozen, stuck.
So, you know, the conflict is always there too. There's enough of the idea of happiness so that we accept the world as our God. But the real purpose of the world is to remind us that that we're separate, and so that conflict is going to be there too.
It's kind of like bait for a fish, right?
Yes.
Put salmon eggs on the hook.
Yes, yes.
Once you're hooked.
Yes, exactly. And let's go back to sentence 18, because I accidentally skipped this paragraph, but it's the same kind of idea. The world contains different places that look different and seem different in weather, formation, and animal life. Each place has its beauty that you may commune with, but each place also offers threats to remind you that it's separate. So, you know, you absolutely love the desert, you love the openness, you love the fact that you can see for 80 miles off your back porch, but man, when you go for a walk, you better watch for those rattlesnakes, you know. Or when you're hiking, you better watch for those bears and mountain lions. Or when you're sailing, you have to watch for those sudden storms that come up. You know, so you have this ability to commune with your environment. Because again, our spirit would not accept a world where we couldn't commune with our environment. It's natural for us to disappear into and be one with our environment at some point. We have to have that. But because the world is our false god, it also has the rattlesnakes and the sudden storms and the bears and the mountain lions and, you know, everything else to keep that thought in the mind, I'm separate and I got to be careful and I got to protect myself.
It's kind of like Jesus says, seek ye first the kingdom and all these things shall be added unto you. And you're not able to really look upon these things with such beauty and clarity and appreciate them until you accept, until you know where you're looking through,
yeah.
You know, until you're clear on what's looking.
Yes.
You know, because everything has a dual purpose.
A dual purpose.
You know.
Yeah, yes. So now going down to 22. The world is effective as a teacher of separateness because it allows you to join, and still it tells you that you are separate. In this way, it is an effective false god. But can a false god create itself? Can a false god develop and deliver its own messages? Who makes the false god a god? It is the one who worships it that made it. For the one who worships it had a desire, and through the image of the false god, that desire seems to be manifest. So again, it's not the world's fault. You know, it's not that the world is this. I hear this every now and then from people on the spiritual path. You know, the world is this horrible place and I need to get out of here. You know, that's just more judgment. You know, that's actually an error that at some point will be corrected in the mind of anyone who feels that way. You know, it's not that the world is this horrible place and I need to get out of here. Is that I have this desire to believe I'm separate that's in my mind, and the world is answering that desire. What needs to happen is that I need to let go of that desire. And you know, it's very easy to say, okay, well, you know, I don't want that desire anymore. I'm letting go of it. But what we don't see is how we continue to wish it. So as we go forward in NTI, it's going to really show us how we continue to wish it. We need to see exactly how we're saying, I want to feel separate, I want to feel separate. Because at an intellectual level, we'll say that we're done with it. But at another level, you know, dozens if not hundreds of times a day, we're still praying for the belief in separation and not even realizing it. And so we have to see honestly what it is that we're doing. And then we have to, you know, with the heart, start learning to ask for what we really want instead of what we don't want anymore. And again, this will be the focus of NTI Ephesians when we get there. This is just setting us up. So we're the ones that make the world the false god, the teacher of separation. The world could not teach us that. It could not even with its rattlesnakes and its storms and its bears and its mountain lions and its pedophiles and its, you know, murderers. And the world could not teach us separation if we were really done with wanting to learn that lesson. It's impossible. The world doesn't have that power. We're the ones that give it that power. Sentence 34. To one who makes a false god, that god becomes real through worship. Oh, sorry, I skipped 31. I keep skipping paragraphs, you guys, forgive me.
Did you do 27?
Did I do 27? I think so, but you know what? I'll go all the way back to 27. How's that? I did skip less sentence 31. So I'll go back to 27. We'll start there. It is the one who worships it that made it. For the one who worships... Oh, no, maybe I didn't. It is the one who worships it that made it. For the one who worships it had a desire. And through the image of the false god, that desire seems to be manifest. But is the message of the false god true if it was made apart from God and attributed to an image that isn't real? What keeps the false message alive within experience? It is the mind of its maker that holds up the false image through its worship of the false image and its practice of its message. Without the involvement of its maker, the false god is without power, because the false god is without power. All power is of its maker. To one who makes a false god, that god becomes real through worship. No longer does the god seem lifeless, but the god seems real and powerful through the worship that is given it. Then the maker, who was the cause of the god, seems to become subject to the god, which now seems to be maker. This is as it seems, and this is how it is believed and practiced. But what seems is not truth, and what is truth is not changed by that which seems. So what this is saying, of course, is it's our desire for separation that creates this appearance of threat in the world, right? But then we aren't consciously aware of that. And so when we see threat in the world, we believe we're victim to that threat. You know, and that's just undoubtedly true. You know, if we were on the beach of Thailand when a great big tidal wave came, you know, we're going to feel like victim that tidal wave, and we got to get the hell out of here or we're going to die. You know, if you're in a shopping mall and a bunch of guys come in with guns and start shooting, you know, chances are the only thought that most of us are going to have is, shit, and hit the ground or run or get out of here because I'm about to die. You know, it's just like, you know, we totally believe we're victims of this world, where I'm this separate me with a very short lifespan. Even if we sit here and say that, you know, I believe in eternal life, when push comes to shove, I got to save my skin because I don't. You know, I don't. I'm about to die and I got to get out of this situation as quickly as possible so that I can live. That's what's really going on in our psyche, because that's what we still believe. So we can sit around and talk about, oh, I believe in eternal life, blah, 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 blah. But when somebody sticks a gun up against our head, that's when we find out what we really believe, right? Or when we see a car coming straight at us in traffic, right? Or a mountain lion looking at us from on top, from, you know, on top of the cliff right there. Then what we find out is we believe, I'm this mortal body and I'm going to die. You know, that's our belief. So what this is saying is completely true. We believe we are the victim of the world, right? We really do.
It's the reversal of cause and effect.
It's the reverse of cause and effect. Yeah, the reverse of cause and effect. And we will believe that until we have an honest awakening. Mm-hmm. You know, spirituality, you know, isn't truly an intellectual thing. You know, that's the problem that most of us have, and as some of you know, it's the problem I'm focused on undoing right now, is that on the spiritual path, we actually go through a period of time, and it could last a long period of time, where we're letting go of some old beliefs, but we're taking on new ones. And we think that's awakening, and it's not. It's replacing beliefs for beliefs. And at some point, we realize what we've done, and then we have to start the whole process of undoing again, but now we're letting go of all these spiritual beliefs, and we're starting to realize we don't know anything. We're trying to become that true innocence of I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, so that we can be the pure openness where the realization comes upon. At some point, we don't want the intellectual anymore, we want the true realization. And every time we notice we've adopted another intellectual belief, we want to drop it, because we know that's just another obstacle. More spiritual sounding, true, but yet it's still an obstacle, because I think I know.
Powerful identity.
Powerful identity. Yeah, the spiritual ego is the popular name for it, right?
The water doesn't get any wetter.
The water doesn't get any wetter, yeah. Yeah, and the mountain lion's going to scare us just as much. Nothing's changed.
Just don't take it personally.
Yeah. So, all right. So, verses 21 to 31. Paul shares the story of Hagar and Sarah and Abraham's two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. He uses this story to teach a lesson that the story may be used to remember. Let me do the same. For all things may be used figuratively to teach the message of the Holy Spirit. So this was the story I told you last week about Abraham and his wife, Sarah, which I think he's going to retell the story here, so I don't think I need to tell you again. Let's just go ahead and read. Abraham's wife, Sarah, was barren. And Abraham had faith in the Lord. And remember I told you Abraham was the first one to hear an inner voice, hear a God. Right? So, you know, he was, unless you count Noah, which for some reason nobody counts when they give Abraham credit for being the first one. I mean, there's just too many centuries between them. But, you know, he's credited with being the first one. And, you know, so, but he believed this inner voice. He had faith in it, right? So Abraham had faith in the Lord. This is like you. So he's liking you to Abraham, who look on the world and do not see promise. And yet you have faith that there must be promise you cannot see. So he's saying, you know, Abraham was really just like you. Because, you know, here's Abraham hearing this voice that nobody's ever heard before. And it's guiding him to take his people into the desert and to wander for years and years and years looking for this promised land. And he trusts it. But at the same time, you know, there's got to be some seed of doubt back there too. Because he doesn't have any proof. You know, he only has faith. And what Jesus is saying here is, you know, those of you who are sitting here, you know, studying NTI or studying the course or whatever, you're really much like that. You're doing this on faith. You don't actually know truth yet, which is what we just talked about. But there's something in you that wants it, or something in you that trusts it's got to be there. And so you're doing this out of faith. That's why you're here. Abraham's wife wished that he had a child, just as you wish to know yourself complete. So she gave him her slave girl, Hagar, and Hagar bore a child from Abraham. It was sometime later that Sarah, through the miracle of God, became pregnant and bore Abraham a child. Where there was thought to be no promise, there was promise. But it was not seen when the barren womb was understood and believed to be real. So what's being said here is, you know, God promised Abraham that Sarah would at some point have a child. And Abraham wanted to believe God. He wanted to. But everything he knew was a barren womb doesn't bear children. So on the one hand, he's got this faith, you know, but on the other hand, he's got this doubt. And so when Sarah comes forth with this plan of hers, hey, I know how you can have a child. Take Hagar. Abraham didn't say, no, I'll wait for the child God promised. Abraham said, okay, maybe this is how it's going to happen, right? And we do that all the time, you know. We compromise on our faith. And the reason we compromise on our faith is because we also still have doubt. so we don't hold out for the miracle. Right? So so Hagar comes and they have a child, but then Sarah also becomes pregnant. So I'll read 11 again. It was sometime later that Sarah, through the miracle of God, became pregnant and bore Abraham a child. Where there was thought to be no promise, there was promise, but it was not seen when the barren womb was understood and believed to be real. Abraham's first son, Ishmael, came from belief in the world. So this is why Abraham said yes to the plan to take Hagar and have a child with her. Because even though God had promised that Sarah would have a child, and even though Abraham wanted to believe it, he couldn't quite. Because you know what? The world seems real, and barren women in their 90s do not have children, right? Just doesn't happen. Yeah. So Ishmael came from belief in the world. Abraham's second son, Isaac, was born of a miracle. Through him is seen a promise that God's love rules over the illusion of the world. And in this story, there is a message for you that does not come from your false God. The message is this: believe not your God. What you see is not truth. Hold to your faith and wait in patience for what must come to show you the world is not real. Now, from time to time, people will receive a guidance. You know, I'll just tell you one of mine because I don't know anybody else's, so I'll have to tell you one of my stories. One guidance that I received at some point, you know, when NTI was coming, I was posting NTI daily on two Yahoo groups. So there were people from the very beginning who were studying it. And before NTI was even done, it had 300 students around the world, right? And these 300 students already loved NTI, and they were excited about it being published as a book. And so people would start talking when it was only halfway done. Start talking about, wow, you got to find a publisher, blah, 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 blah. And so at first I said okay to that. But then after I said okay to that, I had this intuitive feeling, very strong intuitive feeling, that I was not to look for a publisher, one would be provided, right? Now, if you know anything about the world, that doesn't happen. You don't sit in your house on a sofa and publishers come knocking on the door saying, hey, have you written any books lately? You know, it's just not the way it works. You know, you're supposed to do your market research, pick out the publishers that are best for you. You're supposed to do all this research for them to show them, you know, how your book is going to sell, and you send it, and then you're supposed to have patience for like 35, 40 rejection letters until the right one finally comes. My guidance was to do nothing. So I finished writing NTI, and my guidance was still to do nothing. Now, during this doing nothing period, there were still things happening. We had, two other women came to my house, and we went through all of NTI, and where I had, out of fear, changed things from the original notes, we changed them back to the original notes. The suggestion came from Dove that I do an index, so this NTI index thing happened. So there was still work going on, but the basic book was done. People are saying, you need to get a publisher, you need to look for a publisher. I had this guidance, do nothing, do nothing, do nothing. One time I was at a conference, there was a publisher of course material, like no further away from me than that clock. And there was a guy standing next to me saying, you know, there's so-and-so, you need to go over there and talk to him, tell him about NTI. And I said, you know, my guidance is not to do anything. And this guy started yelling at me. He says, you're blowing it. He's right there. You know, this is your time. That would be like taking Hagar, right? He's right there. Just go over there and talk. I mean, you know, how far is that? 20 feet away, you know? But that would be like taking Hagar. And I said, no. But at that moment, my doubt really rose because the thought in my mind, even as I was saying no, was, am I screwing up here? That was my thought. Am I missing my chance? Am I supposed to go talk to this guy? Right? But I didn't. But what ended up happening a couple months later is Nook Sanchez, who I hadn't met. Nook Sanchez was actually networking in the community. And I think Gary Renard told her to call Pathways of Light and get to know them. Pathways of Light told her to call David Fishman and get to know him. And David Fishman suggested that, you know, that she call me. You know, she's just meeting people. So she calls me on the phone, and we're just talking, and she tells me about what she's doing. And she asked me what I was doing, and I told her about NTI. And she said, do you have a publisher yet? And I said, oh, no. I said, my guidance is not to look for one. And she said, you should call my publisher. And I said again, oh, no, you know, my guidance is not to look for one. And then she said, I swear I could hear her lean forward. She said, Regina, I think you've got a green light on this one. And when she said it, I felt it go right through my heart. And I thought, oh, my God, this one's it. This one's it. So I sent NTI to her publisher, and within 24 hours had a contract. It was just the easiest thing in the world. So the moral of the story is that when most people are faced with similar situations, in whatever way those situations arise for them, where they know they're not to do anything, they know they're to wait, you know, something tells them, but then Hagar shows up, they take Hagar. You know, that would have been like if I had walked over and talked to that publisher. And what this is saying is, don't do that. When you do that, you're believing in the belief in separation. You're believing you have to make it happen. Wait for the promise of God. Because when you wait for the promise of God and it happens through no real involvement on your own, where you're not the doer, that's when you start to realize the truth of there's something beyond me. It goes beyond just a faith, just a hope, to an actual realization, I didn't do that. Right? That happened. That came from something else. There has to be something else because that came in that way. So it's asking us to hold out for the real experience when our opportunity arises. And it's up to everyone to know their own opportunity. You know, you have to know your own opportunity. But beware of Hagar. Beware of taking that extra effort that really you know you shouldn't be taking. Wait. Okay? So it's a good story, a good symbol, huh?
Yeah.
So starting with 21. In the story of Sarah and Hagar, Sarah asked Abraham to send Hagar away. Abraham asked God, what should I do? God answered that he should listen to his wife. This was not a rejection of Hagar by God, for God does not reject. This is a symbol to help you see. The releasing of Hagar represents the releasing of faith in the world. For as long as you hold to your faith in the world, you are not placing your faith fully with God. In all of this, I give you symbols to help you learn that the truth is beyond the false. The false will speak first and seem to make sense, but I have shown you that is not of God. Be not tempted by the first or by its promises of salvation. That is not where salvation lies. Wait for God, which does not come from the world. It is through the experience of God that you will learn the truth of God is eternal and beyond the empty promises of the world. Another simple example is my friend Cheryl Valentine. Cheryl Valentine, I don't know if she had this experience before the Seven Steps to Awakening, but I know she had it with the Seven Steps to Awakening. When I started contemplating the Seven Steps to Awakening, and then, you know, by this point, I'm actually a fairly skilled contemplator. So contemplation is easy for me. I contemplate something for a very short time, and then something from beyond my thinking mind comes very easily. Well, Cheryl wanted to do the Seven Steps too, but she wasn't as skilled at contemplating, and things did not come like that for her. She didn't have to just sit there for 10 seconds and then start writing the stuff, you know? But Cheryl chose not to write from her intellectual mind. She chose to set and wait as long as it took. And sometimes I think she would sit with one quote for quite a long period of time, maybe even a couple of hours, and just read it and sit with it and read it and sit with it. But then guess what eventually happened? Something came that she knew was beyond herself. So that's another example of waiting for God. You know, a lot of people, you know, would say, oh, I can't. And then they would just start writing from their intellectual mind. And oftentimes you can tell when people do this because, well, the easiest way to tell if somebody is writing from their mind is it will sound just exactly like whatever it is they study. So like if they study the course, it's going to sound kind of like, you know, burping up the course, you know. And typically when something comes through us, it has its own unique sound, its own unique language. It might even use its own unique words. You know, it's like somehow God expresses itself uniquely through each of us. So you can tell whether you're just burping up what you've read, you know, because you didn't wait, or whether you waited and something came. There's also the way it feels is different. You know, when it's coming from your intellect, you're kind of writing what you already know because this is what you think it's supposed to say. When it's coming from beyond you, there's an aha there, or a deepening of something. Something is happening, right? It's taking you beyond where you already were.
It's alive.
Yeah. So even in contemplation, you know, often people do not wait for God. They just start writing what they intellectually know, you know. So this is encouraging us to wait for God, because it's through waiting for God that we go beyond faith to an actual experience of something beyond this little person, right? And you need that actual experience. Faith is nice, but it's never going to be enough. At some point, you need some real experience that there's something here beyond this world, something here beyond this self, right? So, we only got one chapter done. Gosh, we read for 45 whole minutes there in one chapter. But it's a good chapter. And again, I don't know for certain that you will have opportunities this week to wait for God. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. But I would say just watch and see. You know, maybe contemplation is one of those opportunities. You know, start noticing if you're contemplating something, but you're, you know, kind of wanting to not wait. Maybe meditation is an opportunity. Maybe you'll have some guidance, and maybe you won't have an honest opportunity this week. I don't want you making up opportunities, because, you know, the invitation to wait has to come from God too, right? So if you don't have the opportunity this week, that's fine. But why don't we just say, just kind of be aware. Notice if there's an opportunity to wait for God, for something, for anything. And notice if you're getting scared and trying to jump the gun because of your doubt. And you're trying to take care of it yourself because of your doubt. Because you're afraid to actually wait and see if God will show up in whatever that is. Okay? All right, good. Then I'll go ahead and turn off the recorder and we can go into some silence.